three section. This is how that building actually is. And why it's interesting in regard to this business of centers is because what we have here is a tiny little hole in the middle of the floor. Then through that is a tiny chapel underneath it, where you can see the impost hole, which is where the inverted crucifix was put to crucify St. Peter, apparently. This is the story. So, you know, here we have another kind of almost subterranean center in this thing, plus another altar, plus another center of the dome, plus another candida here. So you get up to 11. So these things just kind of multiply each other. And this is an extremely interesting building because of the extraordinary way in which this thing is hidden. So you really are very little conscious of it when you're there. Actually, I didn't realize that there was a subsidiary chapel. I'd been to the building and I didn't actually realize it. So what we have then is in a class of buildings which are designated as central, some difficulty in defining the locus of the center. Now, this isn't, I must emphasize, this isn't a question of the definition in the word. I mean, we could throw the word centrality and centralized buildings away, and still we'd have the same problem because of the difference between the perception of the thing and its actual constitution. That's where it's not just a kind of problem in nomenclature and us saying, well, we won't call them centralized buildings anymore. It's much more cogent than that. It's much more important. You can look all the way through the annals of Renaissance architecture. You find very, very few buildings which try and constitute something on a given center, despite this infatuation with the Pantheon, which was much more like that. And the only one that does is this here, which is a project by Leonardo da Vinci from about 1490 for a place for preaching in, where you get an entirely spherical auditorium, in fact, and a column on which the preacher was to rise on a stair, stand here, and actually give out the word. Though even this, in the other drawing that he does of it, has a little hemispherical cap shoved on top of that at a different center. But despite that, I mean, it's obviously the most effectively central building of any sort, and it doesn't relate to what we've been looking at all. It's a completely different enterprise with a completely different ambition attached to it. It has nothing to do with the centrality of the dispersed and pleonastic centrality of centralized churches. But all this is still in the region of rumor, partly because what we've been looking at is the forms themselves. And we can attribute certain meanings to those forms, courtesy of Wolfflin and the Neoplatonic commentaries, that the hemisphere represents the sphere of the heavens and so on and so forth, and the cube represents the earth. But that really is about it. What I think now is then interesting is to look at buildings where the images start to float into place into the schema of things and to see what happens then. See what these things are actually indicating in relation to a very explicit iconography in the object about their own constitution, what belongs where, what's central, who's central, all these kinds of problems. And one way to look at that is to look at what's painted on the domes. And this is more or less constant in terms of its general configuration from the 5th century right through to the 18th, that we always have God in the middle, like that. And then we have this effulgence behind, like so. This is Correggio in the early 16th century. He starts this in 1518 in Parma. And it's the first of a series of frescoes which are now exploiting the new intelligence about perspective effects, this kind of vertiginous perspective upwards, in a very, very intelligent way indeed. And what you see then is, well, these rather corporeal saints and humans around here, then this cloud, and then the effulgence behind, and then the rising figure of John the Baptist, because this is dedicated to him. But basically, the hierarchical structure is very, very clear in that, isn't it? Likewise, on the dome of the cupola of Santa Maria del Fiore in Florence, which was Brunelleschi's dome, but this is Vasari and Zuccari who do the painting. Actually, you can't see this terribly well, but again, we have actually the devils and the and hell around here, and then we have the sort of human condition sort of around here somewhere. Then we have rings of angels and so on and so forth up until we get to this canopy with this great light penetrating through from the top. All very straightforward, no problems at all. Here's another one. This is from Lomazzo, later 16th century, in a small chapel in Milan. what you can see here is three things really that become important here. Firstly, what kind of universe is this anyway that these things are supposed to be representing? I mean, what kind of representation are we talking about? Actually, there's two very different ways things can represent something else, aren't there? I mean, it can resemble it. Like, if I'm looking like somebody else, you can say I resemble them. If I say, here's a little ball and here's this rod, and I spin the ball around and I show it to you and I say, this resembles the diurnal rotation of the Earth. And you say, oh yeah, I sort of understand what I mean. Because it's a model of the thing, it's like it. The resemblance carries the meaning. On the other hand, I can say to you, this represents the Trinity. You see, and it might, because we can insist that it does, and it's a truly arbitrary attribution of meaning. Now, words are like that. Obviously, there's no special meaning in the word normally; it's arbitrary. But paintings are not. Paintings are utterly ambivalent. And what about architecture? Where does that sit in this scheme of things? What is it resembling, and how is it resembling it? Is it resembling it at all, or is it entirely a kind of arbitrary issue, saying this represents the Holy Trinity, that represents God, and the one is on top of the other. That's all right. No problem. Now, it seems to me that really is what the argument between Voltaire and Witkowal was about, and it's an argument which can't be got rid of. It's there all the time in the way we understand things, because we can read them either way. There's no special dispensation which says things have to be seen in terms of resemblance, and that's the only meaning they have, or things have to be seen symbolically, and that's the only, or as signs, and that's the only meaning that they really have. It's not like that. We have to discern between these two very different modes of meaning. So what about these things in that light? Well, the universe that they describe is a spherical one, isn't it? I mean, it is actually spherical. That's what Ptolemy says. This is the cosmology that is accepted by the Catholic Church, and so that's fine. So the sphere represents the fact of a sphere. That's resemblance. That's straightforward. No symbolization there, except in terms of resemblance. But then we have another thing which is a little more difficult. This universe is packed with souls. I mean, we've read Dante. It's Dante from other sources in the early Christian period, but it's Dante in particular who makes the universe into a plenum of figures who are actually spiritual figures. They have no actual body, but they're always there. There's these nine rings of them. You start off with angels, then archangels, and then thrones, and then dominions, and then so on and so forth, cherubim and seraphim, right up to the prima mobile and God himself, who is somehow out there in the outer periphery of these onion-like rings, one on top of another. And what's in the middle? Well, it's the earth. That's also Ptolemaic cosmology. The earth is in the middle, and God is up there. So we look at these and we think we've got a perfectly good picture of that, except that the whole picture has been inverted. The whole picture's been turned inside out, hasn't it? Because actually God is in the middle. He's not outside. Well, we can't tell because we're using perspective. This is why these particular things are so brilliantly contrived. They have their cake and eat it brilliantly, just because of that. We can't tell whether it's actually meant to be the center or whether it's the most remote and most kind of enveloping thing that we're looking at when we're looking at this great effulgence at the top of the dome there at all. Perspective makes it ambiguous in that regard. In another respect, these things are actually easily modelable. That is that it's like one sphere inside another, that if we think of these things as these the circles of increasingly spiritual being, as described by Dante, and as mapped on all these donical surfaces, then the dome, as it were, cuts through them, cuts through this solid of spiritual beings in order to make them visible. That's the way that the narrative of the Divine Comedy works anyway. Dante going from the earth through the first, through the second layer, through the third layer, up and up and up and up, until he reaches this point here. Well, that's really an interesting one, isn't it? But nevertheless, those pictures, those dome frescoes, with their immensely intelligent deployment of perspective illusionism, actually make theology, cosmology, architecture, and poetry all seem to belong together perfectly, with no real remainder or excess. Everything seems to have been taken care of very well, and one has to regard them very highly for that alone. But then look at this, which is a painting by a Florentine artist called Botticini, done in the 1470s. And it's rather disconcerting, because right at the center of this thing is that, which is, it's a tomb. It's a tomb of Mary. And you could say, well, it's to do with the subject matter of the thing, which is the assumption of Mary. But really, it presages a much deeper difficulty, a real problem. This, I think you can hardly see it, is Botticelli's illustration to the Divine Comedy, one of the various illustrations that he does. the centre, what's at the centre? What's at the centre of the universe? According to every cosmology, the official theology of the Church, Ptolemaic cosmology, Platonic, Aristotelian, whatever it was, they all had the same idea, that actually at the middle of the universe was the worst thing. That's what was at the middle of the universe. If you read Dante, what's in the middle of the universe? It's God. It's the devil's frozen anus. He eats people and then spews them out in this kind of frozen state. That's the core of the universe. Even in Ficino, who did away with the devil, I mean, he was a very kind of delicate fellow. Ficino, incidentally, is the major Neoplatonist philosopher of in Florence during the 15th century, mid-15th century. He does away with the devil, but for him, it's just cold clay, where not the slightest scintilla of spirit can penetrate, just hard, cold, dense matter. That's what's at the center of the universe. Now, this leads to a problem. The problem is not one of my invention. You can see it here in these depictions of the cosmos. Now, this is an early 15th century painting by... I'm losing this. I can't remember the name. Giovanni de Paola. And it's Expulsion from Paradise. But here you see, there it is, look, this ectopic broken crust of Earth right in the middle there. Then all these rising spheres, and then this figure at the top, who is God, pushing this thing around like a bicycle wheel at the top there. Isn't that a problem? Because we always understand the center of power as an emanation. Isn't that normally the way we understand things? You throw a rock into a pool and you get this emanation of ripples. You switch a light on, you get an emanation of light. We understand these as physical principles very well, and that isn't some scientific idea being projected back onto the 15th century. So did everybody then as well. Emanation was the way in which force was understood to operate. God is the greatest power in the universe, but, and this is where the mystification comes in, is he a power in terms of emanation, or is he a power in terms of envelopment, this thing that goes around it, because he's infinite as well. So how can these two kinds of authoritative quality coexist in the same thing? And in these early things, of course, you get these sort of double pictures. On the one hand, we have God pushing the thing around from the outside, an enveloping thing. But to illustrate the fact of his force, we have this corona, this aureole around him, this great splurge of light. Now what? I mean, we have all sorts of sources of light, but what, at this point, would you think that would represent, that corona of light? What would it be like? Just talking in terms of resemblance. It's surely like the sun, isn't it? What else could it be like at this point in time? This is another illustration of Dante from Botticelli, because Dante has the same problem. I mean, this is a problem everywhere. It's not just in churches. It's there in theology. There are theological... This is a fantastic effect. I do like it. It must be something to do with people going to sleep. There must be some kind of sensor, and they just make it strange. I'm sure it's purposeful, anyway. In Dante, has this Canto 23 of Paradise. This point at which you go through that last sphere, and then what happens? And in fact, it's a bit disconcerting, because he says... he has this terrible, sudden, staggering insight into what's going on. He says he's terribly upset, because he'd been going through up and up and up, and as each as the lightness of being had increased, as he goes up, things get closer and closer to God, as he goes out from the universe. And here you can see, well, you can just about see, should be over there somewhere, I can't even see it. But there is, in fact, a sign of Taurus, and there are these great rings in the Botticelli diagram, indicating the outer rim, the outer sphere of stars. And then beyond that, Dante and Beatrice pop out of this system. And he says, each sphere with God's own love being more instilled, the further from its center it appears. That was the original thing. Then suddenly, he's presented with this complete inversion. All this thing turns into a sudden spot of light, and this is now the center of the universe. That's God. And it's infinitesimal, but it's so bright you can't understand it. And so with these kind of oxymoronic properties, you know, kind of tiny but infinite, he starts to describe this thing. And this is what Botticelli is also having trouble illustrating here. So there's that center with God. There's another little Marian center there that indicates Mary. There's another kind of circle here, a kind of anthropocentric one around these two. But these are kind of incidental. But the real problem is between this one and this point of emanation there. So let's go back to this thing about the sun. The sun in Ptolemaic cosmology is a sort of intermediate thing. So's man, really. It's not man who's at the center of the universe. Man is kind of halfway between, in this kind of borderland between spirit and matter. There's a kind of shoreline between them. And because of this borrowed properties of each, that gives him his special characteristics. He's in the middle of the system, but he's not at the center of it at all. He's in the middle of these transactions between these two very different phenomena, matter and spirit. Then above that, you get the more and more celestial spheres, and then in the middle of those, you get the sun, fourth sphere up. Fair enough, and it's kind of wandering around in its orbit. All of which is a remarkable achievement, because it's not the way you see things. Ptolemaic astronomy is already not the way you see things. It's normally assumed to be that everybody understands that the Earth is the center of the universe, and the sun is sort of somehow in between, and the stars are outside. But it demotes the sun in large measure. Now, the problem with what we've been looking at is this, that wherever you look in Christian iconography, we have these great patches of light, these great aureoles and things that look like brightness. That's what illustrates spirit. Spirit and light are identical. In one place, Derrida says that the whole history of Western philosophy can be written as a photology, as a preoccupation with light. And that's true of Christian theology as well. But with one notable modification is that it can't be the light of the sun. The sun is actually very, very close to being totally heretical if you consider it as central. Partly because it was the first problem that occurred in Christianity was that after Constantine came in and said, Christ was the savior of the world, but also identified him with the Son. When he died and his nephew came into power, Julian the Apostate, Julian decided to do away with the Christ part of that and just keep the Son. From that point on, the Son became really suspect, and in fact, all the astral identities in relation to Christianity became very, very suspect. But they're always there, they never go away, they're just hanging around all the time as sort of metaphors for spirituality, but not to be identified as sort of as identical to it. Now, I just want to go through this because here we have another instance with Raphael, coming back to Raphael, 1508, the same year that he starts the Santa Legio, and he does this painting called The Disputer. And a common place of Raphael criticism is that it's a very silly title for it, The Disputer, because you can look at it and it's, there's obviously no dispute taking place, is there? I mean, it's a very calm and serene piece. That's what they say. that might well be true when you look at it. I mean, it seems a reasonable thing to say. And because the only reason that it's called the disputa is because of the use of the verb disputare when Vasari describes this thing in his Lives of the Artists, you see. He's talking about this disputation that's taking place between all these doctors of the church around here on the issue of the Eucharist. The Eucharist is what this thing is representing. The Eucharist is the main sacrament of the church. It's the thing that happens in the churches. And this thing is like a kind of painted architecture. It has all the characteristics of the church that he just designed, Santa Legio. And it's particularly true, this comparability, in terms of this distribution of centers, because we could almost kind of go one for one. I mean, there's the what's left of the horizon line indicating the point of vision, which is in this instance eccentric to the picture, of course. Then there's that, this pinned body of Christ and the crucifix there. Then there's the Holy Spirit, which actually occupies the center, which would be equivalent to the center of the sphere of the pendentives in the church. That's the position of it. Now, very interesting there, you have these four they're normally evangelists on the pendentives. That's what's normally painted there. But here there's little angels holding up the four books of the evangelists. So that's where they'd go. This then becomes the drum, really. And the figure of Christ is in the middle of that arena where the drum, where anyway all the light comes into the building. Then above that you have this very, very strange, and he's using different techniques of illusionism here, overlaying things one with another, not confusing, but deliberately conflating axiality of one sort and position in perspective with another, so that you can read the position of that figure as either in that ring or in the center. So using ambiguity quite effectively there. But basically that would represent that the center of that drum. Then there's God the Father. Then there's this other thing, this great effulgence, which is sort of outside the building itself, just the way that happens with the lantern in the oculus of Santa Legia. The whole thing is, and you could even say that the orb being held here by the figure of God could be equivalent to the orb on the top of the church, although that's stretching a point a bit far. But basically the configuration is almost identical, and we have the same pleonastic distribution of centers. There's not one, but many in this thing, quite deliberately. It's not an accident. It's perfectly deliberate. Now, let's go back to this thing about disputare. The reason that Vasari used that term is not because he went to this picture and saw people who were looking as if they were having an argument. He wasn't a fool. The reason he used that term was because the Eucharist was the subject of incredible disputation within the history of the church, almost fracturing the church first in the 9th century and then actually fracturing it just around this moment here. So that's why it's called The Disputer, and it seems a pretty good title to me. But the basic upshot of this, anyway, is to just point out that in painting, Raphael is doing something eminently similar to what he's doing in architecture, and that kind of that correspondence, I think, is telling. Now, in terms of, I'm going to have to move fast. Just one little point here. Most of the argument about the perfect nature of the universe in which we live goes from an idea that there is a perfect enveloping spherical figure, and then that perfection is broken as we get in towards this ectopic interior with the Earth in it. And that as this occurs, we simply that is what causes evil and all these other kind of problematic things. But even with the sphere itself, even with the perfect figure, we get exactly the same problem. It is a remarkable thing, I think, that we think of the sphere as the most unified of all figures. Part of the reason for that is because it's the easiest to define in terms of a basic definition. And a sphere is actually just all the points equidistant from another point. That's a pretty cogent, simple definition. And it's slightly more complicated for a circle, but it's still pretty simple. And because we have things like compasses and plain sheets of paper, which is the definition made into instruments and things, it seems that we can't possibly divorce the sphere from its center, or the circle from its center. But actually, the center has nothing to do with it. The center is not essential to either a circle or a sphere, any more than a latus rectum is essential to a parabola. Geometry is full of all these extra bits that are thrown in order to make something definable, but which are extrinsic to its definition. And there are plenty of ways to define a circle without having any recourse to a centre whatsoever. I mean, I could go through some, but it doesn't really matter. I mean, you can just imagine it in terms of getting a bicycle and fixing the wheel at an angle, and you can just pedal along. As long as you're on a flat surface, you'll go in a circle, but you don't know anything about the centre. And there are plenty of other of actual constructions which don't use it. Now, it would have been silly to get rid of the centre, but the thing that I'm trying to point out is that it is, in fact, a dual system. The centre has been kept with the circle in a way that happens with no other figure. It's the only inessential bit that stays with the figure. That's very peculiar, that. And I think, again, it's part of this strange ambiguity that surrounds this whole subject. Of trying to construe a world which has a figure to it, and then maintain the fact that figure is still effective, even though all the evidence in the world is pointing against it. Now, I just very quickly want to go through some of this evidence that is going the other way to get to the point of this whole enterprise here. We talked about the role of the sun here, and how it seems to be imminent in much of this in the iconography, but sort of played down. During the 15th century, something very, very strange happens. It's the same man, Ficino, who is renowned throughout Europe during this period, who writes four books on the sun between 1456 and 1478. The first one is just called The Sun. The last one is involving a comparison between the sun and God. This is really new stuff. Well, it's poetic. It's just poetry. He says it's merely allegory. But he's writing four books on it, and he keeps saying, using the most ambiguous language here. What's he trying to do? What he's, I think, trying to do is to try to get the system into some kind of coherence. That all this business about emanation and on the one hand, and envelopment on the other hand, that was making it impossible to have a resemblance between a picture of the universe as we make it and the real thing. All those ideas would be resolved if you simply put the sun in the middle. That would do it. It would be light, it would be God, and it would just turn the system round. It would do it wonderfully. At exactly the same moment in time, that's what Copernicus is doing. Copernicus has just read Ficino. He quotes him. So we know all these things linked together. Copernicus is a long way away. He's in Poland. But that's, and he comes to Rome in 1530, so he's there a bit later, and that's when he publishes uh, the first uh, the first accounts of the heliocentric system. But that's what's actually going on here. Now that, it does two things. It keeps the coherence going in one mode, and it disrupts reality completely in the other. That is, it disrupts everything about the rest of the system in order to achieve that that homogeneity within the system. Now, this is the Ptolemaic system, and you could argue it technically. I mean, and that's sometimes done, that the problem with Ptolemaic astronomy was that it couldn't predict much, and anyway, it wasn't circles. It had the Earth in the middle, but they had to have all these epicycles on deference, and then epicycles on epicycles, little circles going round on circles, which had this strange machinery of very peculiar trajectories, which would be described in order to account for appearances, for the way that planets did seem to wander around the sky rather aimlessly. So all of that seemed to be a rather kind of cumbersome machinery of explanation. And obviously Copernicus' first stab was to try and simplify that. And so the actual published diagram on the revolutions is this one, which shows the whole thing completely rationalized within that circular schema. But of course, he maintains the circle. What above all Copernicus wants to maintain is the circle. He will not give it up at any price. The circle is so much a matter of assumption in Copernicus that while he makes a list of axioms and assumptions at the very beginning of On the Revolutions, that's not among them. He leaves it out. It's so... I mean, yet it's completely invulnerable. He will never give up the idea of circular orbits. Even Kepler, for half his life, didn't. And it was only after pushing this system and pushing it that he finally came up with elliptical orbits. But that is a measure of the prejudice in favor of this figure here and the resolution of it in these terms. The resolution was actually, it was a complete and utter failure, because if you look at what Copernicus had to do to his own system in order to get the thing to work, it looked even more peculiar and eccentric and perverted than the Ptolemaic one at the same time. But what we're interested in here is not whether it worked or not, but the impetus that made it important to try that new schema out. Now, I'm not trying to give the impression here... this is going to be about something, it doesn't matter. I'm really not trying to give the impression here that what we have is putative Copernican astronomy in these buildings. That isn't what I'm trying to say at all. The point is quite different. It's the opposite. It's that what Copernicus was trying to do was to resolve the difficulty by creating other difficulties, by actually rupturing all the assumptions about the relations of things. What these architects, like Raphael and so forth, were trying to do in these buildings was preserve the sense of a unity which was actually almost impossible to achieve in the world that they occupied. What idea we have of something being the representation of its age, the spirit of the age, I think is a very kind of hazy one. If we think that buildings just represent what people thought at the time, that seems completely off beam. It seems to be nothing about that at all. Here, they seem to be not representing an actual spirit of the age. People were very aware of the fact that this system was falling apart all around them, couldn't be held together, not in theology, not in mathematics, not in astronomy, nowhere. It was falling apart everywhere. At this point, these beautiful, serene, wonderful buildings perform their task. It's a kind of consolation, isn't it? And that's how it seems to me, is that that's the only reasonable explanation for their appearance. They're not actually representing what people believed, they're representing what people would have liked to have believed about the situation, which was clearly not right at this point. If, on the other hand, we choose to take up Witkowa and see them as symbolic representations, what you'd be obliged to do is see them as mendacious, as essentially aligning themselves with truth and then becoming actually the propagators of lies, effectively. That's the only way that you could understand them. Now, I don't think that's right, because in the first place, the buildings have many properties other than that. But and even within that context, they seem to be rather more sentimental, I think, and rather more illusionistic. We're the dupes of that idea, not the people of the 15th century. It's us who are making the identity between what the buildings are signifying and what people actually believed, are foolish enough to believe that the representation is a direct one, when in fact it's elusive and eccentric to the pattern of real belief at this point. This thing was kind of, I'm just trying to indicate now that there were ways out being from this impasse, often being practiced by the same people who were busy making these very same institutions. Alberti and then Leonardo used this map-making technique and can I go back one to the Calvio map? The earlier maps, both of Rome and of various other places, always start off with the idea of the world being the ideal shape. Actually, that Rome is actually a circle, because it's the ideal shape. And you'll start off as putting some particularly significant monument in the center, and the maps of the world are the same, they're circular, and they're with Jerusalem in the center, usually. And then you'll actually make it a circle, because that's the perfect figure. Now, you see what's happening here. You're forcing something that actually obviously doesn't have that shape into that shape in order for it to, as it were, represent some kind of perfection. The thing is less a matter of resemblance, more about a matter of symbolization. But using exactly that same figure, using the circle, which you can see around here, Leonardo, as Alberti had done before him, uses this technique of cartographic mapping, where you just stand on the top of a building and then you take these readings along lines at, I think, 15, might be less than that, 15 degree intervals right round like so, measure the cardinal points of intersection of this thing, what happens to go past it, and then translate that on scale to a map, and so you can make a perfectly accurate map of Imola in 1502, like that. Now, what's happening here is really interesting because the circle, instead of it being kind of forced into the figure of the object, is simply there as a sort of virtual measuring schema. And then the object is being given its definition as a second figure, which need have no correspondence to the first one whatsoever in actual form. And so, as the circle was losing its symbolic power, and this again is an important point to me, that it's, as it loses its symbolic power, it gains in its effective power of describing reality. Because it's still there, but it's there as this kind of sub-schema, this kind of measuring system, which has no absolute reality at all. So we see it there. And I think if one wants a comparison between, as it were, the implausibility of this system and its representation as apparently plausible, immensely beautiful, and perfectly ambiguous in the churches, all one needs to do is look at the treaties on architecture around this period, which have the same ambitions. Taking up, this is from Cesariano's edition of Vitruvius, and in the first chapter of Vitruvius there's this thing about architects having to have conversations with musicians because they understand harmony, and with astronomers because astronomers understand the form of the cosmos, and geometers, sorry, as well, because geometers understand vision. And in doing that, it's a very vague comment, but what Cesariano tries to do here is to show how all these things are actually interrelated. So here we have the sun right at the top here in this diagonal. Here we have a figure and his voice. This is supposed to be, according to Cesariano, the lines of his voice going out here, intersect with the lines of the sun coming down here to produce this harmonic sequence of the positions of the planets going up towards the sun there. And then these things intersect with the schema of radial vision down here to produce a perspective grid. And I could go through this bit by bit to point out all the aberrations in it. But in fact, they're very obvious. I mean, the whole thing doesn't work at all. It's not like these churches where everything is held in abeyance, as if it worked, as if the world was the shape, the ideal shape, as if the ruler and the ruled could occupy the same position and it really didn't make any difference. All those things are catered for in those churches and all fall apart when it comes to something that's supposed to exhibit them without the leisure domain of art attached. Let's just give that up. Okay, so in the end, the situation is a curious one because it appears that what these buildings are representing is actually something which is is neither in the documents testifying to the literal meaning of the elements of composition, nor is it in the sense in the forms. We have to employ both of those to get to this. But it's a third meaning, which is entirely separate from them, and actually gives a very, very different result, it seems to me. And I just simply leave that with you as an observation. You may agree or disagree, but that's it. Thank you.